with the engine just ticking. There was quite a little swell that close in. "Come on back here," I said to Eddie, and I gave him a real drink.
"Do you cock it first with your thumb?"
he whispered to me. He was sitting at the wheel now, and I'd reached up and had both the cases open and the butts pulled out about 6 inches.
"That's right. Oh, boy," he said.
It certainly was wonderful what a drink would do to him and how quick. We lay there, and I could see a light from the delegate's house back through the brush. I saw the two lights on the point go down, and one of them moving off around the point. They must have blown the other one out. Then, in a little while, coming out of the cove, I see a boat come toward us with a man sculling. I could tell by the way he swung back and forth. I knew he had a big oar. I was pretty pleased. If they were sculling, that meant one man. They came alongside.
"Good evening, Captain," said Mr. Singh.
"Come astern and put her broadside," I said to him. He said something to the kid who was sculling, but he couldn't scull her backwards, so I took hold of the gunwale and passed her astern. There were 8 men in the boat. The 6 Chinks, Mr. Singh, and the kid sculling. While I was pulling her astern, I was waiting for something to hit me on top of the head, but nothing did. I straightened up and let Mr. Singh hold on to the stern. "Let's see what it looks like," I said. He handed it to me, and I took the roll of it up to where Eddie was at the wheel and put on the binnacle light. I looked at it carefully. It looked all right to me, and I turned off the light. Eddie was trembling. "Pour yourself one," I said. I saw him reach for the bottle and tip it up. I went back to the stern. "All right," I said. "Let 6 come on board." Mr. Singh and the Cuban that sculled were having a job holding their boat from knocking in what little swell there was. I heard Mr. Singh say something in Chink, and all the Chinks in the boat started to climb onto the stern. "One at a time," I said. He said something again, and then one after another 6 Chinks came over the stern. They were all lengths and sizes.
"Show them forward," I said to Eddie.
"Right this way, gentlemen,"
said Eddie. By God, I knew he had taken a big one.
"Lock the cabin," I said when they were all in.
"Yes, sir,"
said Eddie. "I will return with the others," said Mr. Singh. "Okay," I told him. I pushed them clear, and the boy with him started sculling off.
"Listen," I said to Eddie, "you lay off that bottle. You're brave enough now."
"Okay, chief,"
said Eddie. "What's the matter with you?"
"This is what I like to do," said Eddie. "You say you just pull it backward with your thumb."
"You lousy rummy," I told him. "Give me a drink out of that."
"All gone," said Eddie. "Sorry, chief."
"Listen, what you have to do now is watch when he hands me the money and put her ahead."
"Okay, chief,"
said Eddie. I reached up and took the other bottle and got the corkscrew and drew the cork. I took a good drink and went back to the stern, putting the cork in tight and laying the bottle behind 2 wicker jugs full of water. "Here comes Mr. Singh," I said to Eddie.
"Yes, sir,"
said Eddie. The boat came out sculling toward us. He brought her astern, and I let them do the holding on. Mr. Singh had hold of the roller we had across the stern to slide a big fish aboard. "Let them come aboard," I said, "one at a time." 6 more assorted chinks came on board over the stern. "Open up and show them forward," I told Eddie.
"Yes, sir,"
said Eddie. "Lock the cabin."
"Yes, sir."
I saw he was at the wheel. "All right, Mr. Singh," I said. "Let's see the rest of it." He put his hand in his pocket and reached the money out toward me. I reached for it and grabbed his wrist with the money in his hand. And as he came forward on the stern, I grabbed his throat with the other hand. I felt her start and then churn ahead as she hooked up, and I was plenty busy with Mr. Singh. But I could see the Cuban standing in the stern of the boat holding the sculling oar as we pulled away from her through all the flopping and bouncing Mr. Singh was doing. He was flopping and bouncing worse than any dolphin on a gaff. I got his arm around behind him and came up on it, but I brought it up too far because I felt it go. When it went, he made a funny little noise and came forward, me holding him throat and all, and bit me in the shoulder. But when I felt the arm go, I dropped it. It wasn't any good to him anymore, and I took him by the throat with both hands, and brother, that Mr. Singh could flop just like a fish, true, his loose arm flailing. But I got him forward onto his knees and had both thumbs well in behind his talk box, and I bent the whole thing back until she cracked. Don't think you can't hear it crack either. I held him quiet just a second, and then I laid him down across the stern. He lay there face up, quiet in his good clothes, with his feet in the cockpit, and I left him. I picked up the money off the cockpit floor and took it up and put on the binnacle light and counted it. Then I took the wheel and told Eddie to look under the stern for some pieces of iron that I use for anchoring whenever we fished bottom fishing on patches or rocky bottom where you wouldn't want to risk an anchor.
I can't find anything, he said.
He was scared being down there by Mr. Singh. Take the wheel, I said. Keep her out. There was a certain amount of moving around going on below, but I wasn't spooked about them. I found a couple of pieces of what I wanted, iron from the old coaling dock at Tortugas, and I took some snapper line and made a couple of good big pieces fast to Mr. Singh's ankles. Then when we were about 2 miles offshore, I slid him over. He slid over smooth off the roller. I never even looked in his pockets. I didn't feel like fooling with him. He'd bled a little on the stern from his nose and his mouth, and I dipped a bucket of water that nearly pulled me overboard the way we were going, and cleaned her off good with a scrub brush from under the stern. Slow her down, I said to Eddie.
What if he floats up? Eddie said.
I dropped him in about 700 fathoms, I said. He's going down all that way. That's a long way, brother. He won't float till the gas brings him up, and all the time he's going with the current and baiting up fish. Hell, I said, you don't have to worry about Mr. Singh.
What did you have against him?
Eddie asked me. Nothing, I said. He was the easiest man to do business with I ever met. I thought there must be something wrong all the time.
What did you kill him for?
To keep him from killing 12 other chinks, I told him. Harry, he said, you've got to give me one because I can feel him coming on. It made me sick to see his head all loose like that. So I gave him one.
What about the chinks? Eddie said.
I want to get them out as quick as I can, I told him, before they smell up the cabin.
Where are you going to put them?
We'll run them right into the Long Beach, I told him.
Take her in now?
Sure, I said. Take her in slow. We came in slow over the reef and to where I could see the beach shine. There's plenty of water over the reef, and inside it's all sandy bottom and slopes right into shore. Get up forward and give me the depth. He kept sounding with a grains pole, motioning me on with the pole. He came back and motioned me to stop. I came astern on her.
You've got about 5 feet.
We've got to anchor, I said. If anything happens so we haven't time to get her up, we can cut loose or break her off. Eddie paid out rope, and when finally she didn't drag, he made her fast. She swung stern in.
It's sandy bottom, you know, he said.
How much water have we got at the stern?
Not over 5 feet.
You take the rifle, I said, and be careful.
Let me have one, he said.
He was plenty nervous. I gave him one and took down the pump gun. I unlocked the cabin door, opened it, and said, come on out. Nothing happened. Then one chink put his head out and saw Eddie standing there with a rifle and ducked back. Come on out. Nobody's going to hurt you, I said. Nothing doing. Only lots of talk and chink.
Come on out, you,
Eddie said. My God, I knew he'd had the bottle. Put that bottle away, I said to him, or I'll blow you out of the boat. Come on out, I said to them, or I'll shoot in at you. I saw one of them looking at the corner of the door, and he saw the beach evidently because he begins to chatter. Come on, I said, or I'll shoot. Out they came. Now I tell you, it would take a hell of a mean man to butcher a bunch of chinks like that, and I'll bet there would be plenty of trouble too, let alone mess. They came out and they were scared, and they didn't have any guns, but there were 12 of them. I walked backwards down to the stern holding the pump gun. Get overboard, I said. It's not over your heads. Nobody moved. Over you go. Nobody moved.
You yellow rat-eating aliens, Eddie said. Get overboard.
Shut your drunken mouth, I told him.
No swim,
one chink said. No need swim, I said. No deep.
Come on, get overboard, Eddie said.
Come astern here, I said. Take your gun in one hand and your grain pole in the other and show them how deep it is. He showed them, holding up the wet pole.
No need swim?
The one asked me. No.
True?
Yes.
Where we?
Cuba. "You damn crook," he said, and went over the side, hanging on and then letting go. His head went under, but he came up and his chin was out of water. "Damn crook," he said. "God damn crook." He was mad and plenty brave. He said something in Chink, and the others started going into the water off the stern. "All right," I said to Eddie, "get the anchor up." As we headed her out, the moon started to come up, and you could see the Chinks with just their heads out of water, walking ashore, and the shine of the beach and the brush behind. We got out past the reef, and I looked back once and saw the beach and the mountains starting to show up. Then I put her on her course for Key West. "Now you can take a sleep," I said to Eddie. "No, wait. Go below and open all the ports to get the stink out and bring me the iodine." "What's the matter?" he said when he brought it. I cut my finger. "Do you want me to steer?" "Get a sleep," I said. "I'll wake you up." He lay down on the built-in bunk in the cockpit over the gas tank, and in a little while he was asleep. Chapter 5. I held the wheel with my knee and opened up my shirt and saw where Mr. Singh bit me. It was quite a bite, and I put iodine on it, and then I sat there steering and wondering whether a bite from a Chinaman was poisonous, and listened to her running nice and smooth and the water washing along her, and I figured, hell no, that bite wasn't poisonous. A man like that Mr. Singh probably scrubbed his teeth 2 or 3 times a day. Some Mr. Singh. He certainly wasn't much of a businessman. Maybe he was. Maybe he just trusted me. I tell you, I couldn't figure him. Well, now it was all simple except for Eddie. Because he's a rummy, he'll talk when he gets hot. I sat there steering, and I looked at him, and I thought, hell, he's as well off dead as the way he is, and then I'm all clear. When I found he was on board, I decided I'd have to do away with him. But then when everything had come out so nice, I didn't have the heart. But looking at him lying there, it certainly was a temptation. But then I thought there's no sense spoiling it by doing something you'd be sorry for afterwards. Then I started to think he wasn't even on the crew list, and I'd have to pay a fine for bringing him in, and I didn't know how to consider him. Well, I had plenty of time to think about it, and I held her on her course, and every once in a while I'd take a drink out of the bottle he'd brought on board. There wasn't much in it, and when I'd finished it, I opened up the only one I had left, and I tell you, I felt pretty good steering, and it was a pretty night to cross. It had turned out a good trip all right, finally, even though it had looked plenty bad plenty of times. When it got daylight, Eddie woke up. He said he felt terrible. "Take the wheel a minute," I told him. "I want to look around." I went back to the stern and threw a little water on her, but she was perfectly clean. I scrubbed the brush over the side. I unloaded the guns and stowed them below, but I still kept the gun on my belt. It was fresh and nice as you want it below, no smell at all. A little water had come in through the starboard port onto one of the bunks was all, so I shut the ports. There wasn't a custom house officer in the world could smell Chink in her now. I saw the clearance papers in the net bag hanging up under her framed license where I'd shoved them when I came on board, and I took them out to look them over. Then I went up to the cockpit. "Listen," I said, "how did you get on the crew list?"
"I met the broker when he was leaving for the consulate and told him I was going."
"God looks after rummies," I told him, and I took the .38 off and stowed it down below. I made some coffee down below, and then I came up and took the wheel. "There's coffee below," I told him.
"Brother, coffee wouldn't do me any good."
"You know you had to be sorry for him. He certainly looked bad." About 9 o'clock, we saw the Sand Key light just about dead ahead. We'd seen tankers going up the gulf for quite a while. "We'll be in a couple of hours now," I said to him. "I'm going to give you the same $4 a day just as if Johnson had paid."
"How much did you get out of last night?"
he asked me. "Only 600, I told him. I don't know whether he believed me or not.
"Don't I share in it?"
"That's your share," I told him. "What I just told you. And if you ever open your mouth about last night, I'll hear of it, and I'll do away with you."
"You know I'm no squealer, Harry."
"You're a rummy. But no matter how rum-dumb you get, if you ever talk about that, I promise you."
"I'm a good man," he said. "You oughtn't to talk to me like that."
"They can't make it fast enough to keep you a good man," I told him. But I didn't worry about him anymore because who was going to believe him? Mr. Singh wouldn't make any complaints. The Chinks weren't going to. You know the boy that sculled them out wasn't. He wouldn't want to get himself in trouble. Eddie would mouth about it sooner or later, maybe, but who believes a rummy? Why, who could prove anything? Naturally, it would have made plenty more talk when they saw his name on the crew list. That was luck for me, all right. I could have said he fell overboard, but it makes plenty talk. Plenty of luck for Eddie, too. Plenty of luck, all right. Then we came to the edge of the stream, and the water quit being blue and was light and greenish, and inside I could see the stakes on the eastern and the western dry rocks, and the wireless masts at Key West, and the La Concha Hotel up high out of all the low houses, and plenty smoke from out where they're burning garbage. Sand Key light was plenty close now, and you could see the boathouse and the little dock alongside the light, and I knew we were only 40 minutes away now, and I felt good to be getting back, and I had a good stake now for the summertime. "What do you say about a drink, Eddie?" I said to him. "Ah, Harry," he said, "I always knew you were my pal." That night I was sitting in the living room smoking a cigar and drinking a whiskey and water and listening to Gracie Allen on the radio. The girls had gone to the show, and sitting there I felt sleepy and I felt good. There was somebody at the front door, and Marie, my wife, got up from where she was sitting and went to it. She came back and said, "It's that rummy, Eddie Marshall. He says he's got to see you." "Tell him to get out before I run him out," I told her. She came back in and sat down, and looking out the window where I was sitting with my feet up, I could see Eddie going along the road under the arc light with another rummy he'd picked up, the two of them swaying, and their shadows from the arc light swaying worse. "Poor goddamn rummies," Marie said. "I pity a rummy." "He's a lucky rummy." "There ain't any lucky rummies," Marie said. "You know that, Harry." "No," I said. "I guess there aren't." Part 2. Harry Morgan. Fall. Chapter 6. They came on across in the night, and it blew a big breeze from the northwest. When the sun was up, he sighted a tanker coming down the gulf, and she stood up so high and white with the sun on her in that cold air, it looked like tall buildings rising out of the sea. And he said to the nigger, "Where the hell are we?" The nigger raised himself up to look. "Ain't nothing like that this side of Miami." "You know damn well we ain't been carried up to no Miami," he told the nigger. "All I say, ain't no buildings like that on no Florida Keys. We've been steering for Sand Key." "We've got to see it, then. It or American Shoals." Then a little while he saw it was a tanker and not buildings, and then in less than an hour he saw Sand Key light, straight, thin and brown, rising out of the sea right where it ought to be. "You gotta have confidence steering," he told the nigger. "I got confidence," the nigger said, "but the way this trip gone, I ain't got confidence no more." "How's your leg?" "It hurts me all the time." "It ain't nothing," the man said. "You keep it clean and wrapped up and it'll heal by itself." He was steering to the westward now to go in to lay up for the day in the mangroves by Woman Key, where he would not see anybody and where the boat was to come out to meet them. "You're going to be all right," he told the nigger. "I don't know," the nigger said. "I hurt bad." "I'm going to fix you up good when we get into the place," he told him. "You aren't shot bad. Quit worrying."
"I'm shot," he said. "I ain't never been shot before. Anyway, I'm shot it bad."
"You just scared."
"No, sir, I'm shot. And I'm hurting bad. I've been throbbing all night."
The nigger went on grumbling like that, and he could not keep from taking the bandage off to look at it. "Leave it alone," the man who was steering told him. The nigger lay on the floor of the cockpit, and there were sacks of liquor shaped like hams piled everywhere. He had made himself a place in them to lay down in. Every time he moved, there was the noise of broken glass in the sacks, and there was the odor of spilled liquor. The liquor had run all over everything. The man was steering in for Woman Key now. He could see it now plainly.
"I hurt," the nigger said. "I hurt worse all the time."
I'm sorry, Wesley, the man said, but I got to steer. You treat a man no better than a dog, the nigger said. He was getting ugly now, but the man was still sorry for him. I'm going to make you comfortable, Wesley, he said. You lay quiet now.
You don't care what happens to a man, the nigger said. You ain't hardly human.
I'm going to fix you up good, the man said. You just lay quiet.
You ain't going to fix me up, the nigger said.
The man, whose name was Harry Morgan, said nothing then because he liked the nigger, and there was nothing to do now but hit him, and he couldn't hit him. The nigger kept on talking.
Why didn't we stop when they started shooting?
The man did not answer.
Ain't a man's life worth more than a load of liquor?
The man was intent on his steering.
All we have to do is stop and let them take the liquor.
No, the man said. They take the liquor and the boat and you go to jail.
I don't mind jail, the nigger said, but I never wanted to get shot.
He was getting on the man's nerves now, and the man was becoming tired of hearing him talk. Who the hell's shot worse, he asked him, you or me?
You're shot worse, the nigger said, but I ain't never been shot. I didn't figure to get shot. I ain't paid to get shot. I don't want to be shot.
Take it easy, Wesley, the man told him. It don't do you any good to talk like that. They were coming up on the quay now. They were inside the shoals, and as he headed her into the channel, it was hard to see with the sun on the water. The nigger was going out of his head, or becoming religious because he was hurt. Anyway, he was talking all the time.
Why they run liquor now, he said. Prohibition's over. Why they keep up a traffic like that? Why they bring the liquor in on the ferry?
The man steering was watching the channel closely.
Why don't people be honest and decent, make a decent, honest living?
The man saw where the water was rippling smooth off the bank, even when he could not see the bank in the sun, and he turned her off. He swung her around, spinning the wheel with one arm, and then the channel opened out, and he took her slowly right up to the edge of the mangroves. He came astern on the engines and threw out the two clutches. I can put an anchor down, he said, but I can't get no anchor up.
I can't even move, the nigger said.
You're certainly in a hell of a shape, the man told him. He had a difficult time breaking out, lifting and dropping the small anchor, but he got it over and paid out quite a lot of rope, and the boat swung in against the mangrove so they came right into the cockpit. Then he went back and down into the cockpit. He thought the cockpit was a hell of a sight, all right. All night after he had dressed the nigger's wound and the nigger had bandaged his arm, he had been watching the compass, steering, and when it came daylight he had seen the nigger lying there and the sacks in the middle of the cockpit. But then he was watching the seas and the compass and looking for the sand key light, and he had never observed carefully how things were. Things were bad. The nigger was lying in the middle of the load of sacked liquor with his leg up. There were 8 bullet holes through the cockpit, splintered wide. The glass was broken in the windshield. He did not know how much stuff was smashed, and wherever the nigger had not bled, he himself had bled. But the worst thing, the way he felt at the moment, was the smell of booze. Everything was soaked in it. Now the boat was lying quietly against the mangroves, but he could not stop feeling the motion of the big sea they had been in all night in the gulf. I'm going to make some coffee, he told the nigger. Then I'll fix you up again.
I don't want no coffee.
I do, the man told him, but down below he began to feel dizzy, so he came out on deck again.
I guess we won't have coffee, he said. I want some water.
All right. He gave the negro a cup of water out of a demijohn.
Why you want to keep on running for when they started to shoot?
Why they want to shoot, the man answered.
I want a doctor, the nigger told him.
What's a doctor going to do that I ain't done for you?
Doctor going to cure me.
You'll have a doctor tonight when the boat comes out.
I don't want to wait for no boat.
All right, the man said. We're going to dump this liquor now. He started to dump it, and it was hard work one-handed. A sack of liquor only weighs 40 pounds, but he had not dumped very many of them before he became dizzy again. He sat down in the cockpit, and then he lay down.
You going to kill yourself, the nigger said.
The man lay quietly in the cockpit with his head against one of the sacks. The branches of the mangroves had come into the cockpit, and they made a shadow over him where he lay. He could hear the wind above the mangroves, and looking out at the high, cold sky, see the thin-blown clouds of the norther. Nobody going to come out with this breeze, he thought. They won't look for us to have started with this blowing.
You think they'll come out?
The nigger asked. Sure, the man said. Why not?
It's blowing too hard.
They're looking for us.
Not with it like this. What you want to lie to me for?
The nigger was talking with his mouth almost against a sack. Take it easy, Wesley, the man told him.
Take it easy, the man says, the nigger went on. Take it easy? Take what easy? Take dying like a dog easy? You got me here, get me out.
Take it easy, the man said kindly.
They ain't coming, the nigger said. I know they ain't coming. I'm cold, I tell you. I can't stand this pain and cold, I tell you.
The man sat up, feeling hollow and unsteady. The nigger's eyes watched him as he rose on one knee, his right arm dangling, took the hand of his right arm in his left hand, and placed it between his knees, and then pulled himself up by the plank nailed above the gunwale, until he stood looking down, down at the nigger, his right hand still held between his thighs. He was thinking that he had never really felt pain before. If I keep it out straight, pulled out straight, it don't hurt so bad, he said.
Let me tie it up in a sling, the nigger said. I can't make a bend in the elbow, the man said. It's stiffened that way. What are we going to do?
Dump this liquor, the man told him. Can't you put over what you can reach, Wesley? The nigger tried to move to reach a sack, then groaned and lay back. Do you hurt that bad, Wesley?
Oh, God,
the nigger said. You don't think once you moved it, it wouldn't hurt so bad?
I'm shot, the nigger said. I ain't going to move. The man wants me to go to dumping liquor when I'm shot.
Take it easy.
You say that once more, I go crazy.
Take it easy, the man said quietly. The nigger made a howling noise and, shuffling with his hands on the deck, picked up the whetstone from under the combing.
I'll kill you, he said. I'll cut your heart out.
Not with no whetstone, the man said. Take it easy, Wesley. The nigger blubbered with his face against a sack. The man went on slowly lifting the sacked packages of liquor and dropping them over the side. Chapter 7 While he was dumping the liquor, he heard the sound of a motor, and looking saw a boat headed toward them, coming down the channel around the end of the quay. It was a white boat with a buff-painted house and a windshield. Boat coming, he said. Come on, Wesley.
I can't.
I'm remembering from now on, the man said. Before was different.
Go ahead and remember, the nigger told him. I ain't forgot nothing either.
Working fast now, the sweat running down his face, not stopping to watch the boat coming slowly down the channel, the man picked up the sacked packages of liquor with his good arm and dropped them over the side. Roll over. He reached for the package under the nigger's head and swung it over the side. The nigger sat up. Here they are, he said. The boat was almost abeam of them.
It's Captain Willie, the nigger said, with a party.
In the stern of the white boat, two men in flannels and white cloth hats sat in fishing chairs trolling, and an old man in a felt hat and a windbreaker held the tiller and steered the boat close past the mangroves where the booze boat lay.
What do you say, Harry?
The old man called as he passed. The man called Harry waved his good arm in reply. The boat went on past, the two men who were fishing looking towards the booze boat and talking to the old man. Harry could not hear what they were saying. He'll make a turn at the mouth and come back, Harry said to the negro. He went below and came up with a blanket. Let me cover you up.
About time you cover me up. They couldn't help but see that liquor. What we going to do?
Willie's a good skate, the man said. He'll tell them in town we're out here. Those fellas fishing ain't going to bother us. What they care about us? He felt very shaky now, and he sat down on the steering seat and held his right arm tight between his thighs. His knees were shaking, and with the shaking he could feel the ends of the bone in his upper arm grate. He opened his knees, lifted his arm out, and let it hang by his side. He was sitting there, his arm hanging, and the boat passed them coming back up the channel. The two men in the fishing chairs were talking. They had put up their rods, and one of them was looking at him through a pair of glasses. They were too far out for him to hear what they were saying. It would not have helped him if he had. On board the charter boat South Florida, trolling down the Woman Key Channel because it was too rough to go out to the reef, Captain Willie Adams was thinking, "So Harry crossed last night. That boy's got cojones. He must have got that whole blow. She's a seaboat, all right. How you suppose he smashed his windshield? Damned if I'd cross a night like last night. Damned if I'd ever run liquor from Cuba. They bring it all from Mariel now. It's supposed to be wide open." "What's that you say, Cap?"
"What boat is that?" asked one of the men in the fishing chairs.
"That boat?"
"Yes, that boat."
"Oh, that's a Key West boat."
What I said was, "Whose boat is it?"
"I wouldn't know that, Cap."
"Is the owner a fisherman?"
"Well, some say he is."
"What do you mean?"
"He does a little of everything."
"You don't know his name?"
"No, sir."
"You called him Harry."
"Not me."
"I heard you call him Harry." Captain Willie Adams took a good look at the man who was speaking to him. He saw a high-cheek-boned, thin-lipped, very ruddy face with deep-set gray eyes and a contemptuous mouth looking at him from under a white canvas hat.
"I must have called him that by mistake," Captain Willie said.
"You can see that the man is wounded, Doctor," the other man said, handing the glasses to his companion. "I can see that without glasses," the man addressed as Doctor said. "Who is that man?"
"I wouldn't know," said Captain Willie.
"Well, you will know," the man with the contemptuous mouth said. "Write down the numbers on the bow."
"I have them, Doctor."
"We'll go over and have a look," the doctor said.
"Are you a doctor?"
Captain Willie asked.
"Not of medicine," the gray-eyed man told him. "If you're not a medical doctor, I wouldn't go over there."
"Why not?"
"If he wanted us, he would have signaled us. If he don't want us, it's none of our business. Down here, everybody aims to mind their own business."
"All right, suppose you mind yours, then. Take us over to that boat." Captain Willie continued on his way up the channel, the two-cylinder Palmer coughing steadily. "Didn't you hear me?"
"Yes, sir."
"Why don't you obey my order?"
"Who the hell you think you are?"
asked Captain Willie. "That's not the question. Do as I tell you."
"Who do you think you are?"
"All right, for your information, I'm one of the three most important men in the United States today."
"What the hell are you doing in Key West, then?"
The other man leaned forward. "He's Frederick Harrison," he said impressively.
"I never heard of him," said Captain Willie.
"Well, you will," said Frederick Harrison. "And so will everyone in this stinking jerkwater little town if I have to grub it out by the roots."
"You're a nice fellow," said Captain Willie. "How did you get so important?"
"He's one of the biggest men in the administration," said the other man.
"Nuts," said Captain Willie. "If he's all that, what's he doing in Key West?"
"He's just here for a rest," the secretary explained. "He's going to be governor general of—"
"That's enough, Willis," Frederick Harrison said. "Now will you take us over to that boat?" he said, smiling.
He had a smile which was reserved for such occasions.
"No, sir."
"Listen, you half-witted fisherman, I'll make life so miserable for you."
"Yes,"
said Captain Willie. "You don't know who I am."
"None of it don't mean anything to me," said Captain Willie.
"That man is a bootlegger, isn't he?"
"What do you think?"
"There's probably a reward for him."
"I doubt that.
He's a lawbreaker."
"He's got a family and he's got to eat and feed them. Who the hell do you eat off of with people working here in Key West for the government for $6.50 a week?"
"He's wounded. That means he's been in trouble."
"Unless he shot himself for fun."
"You can save that sarcasm. You're going over to that boat and we're going to take that man and that boat into custody."
"Into where?"
"Into Key West."
"Are you an officer?"
"I've told you who he is," the secretary said.
"All right,"
said Captain Willie. He pushed the tiller hard over and turned the boat, coming so close to the edge of the channel that the propeller threw up a circling cloud of marl. He chugged down the channel toward where the other boat lay against the mangroves. "Have you a gun aboard?" Frederick Harrison asked Captain Willie.
"No, sir."
The two men in flannels were standing up now, watching the booze boat. This is better fun than fishing, eh, Doctor? The secretary said. Fishing is nonsense, said Frederick Harrison. If you catch a sailfish, what do you do with it? You can't eat it. This is really interesting. I'm glad to see this at first hand. Wounded as he is, that man cannot escape. It's too rough at sea. We know his boat. You're really capturing him single-handed, said the secretary admiringly.
And unarmed, too, said Frederick Harrison.
With no G-men nonsense, said the secretary.
Edgar Hoover exaggerates his publicity, said Frederick Harrison. I feel we've given him about enough rope. Pull alongside, he said to Captain Willie.
Captain Willie threw out his clutch and the boat drifted.
Hey,
Captain Willie called to the other boat.
Keep your heads down.
What's that? Harrison said angrily.
Shut up, said Captain Willie. Hey, he called over to the other boat. Listen, get on into town and take it easy. Never mind the boat. They'll take the boat. Dump your load and get into town. I got a guy here on board, some kind of a stool from Washington. More important than the president, he says. He wants to pinch you. He thinks you're a bootlegger. He's got the numbers of the boat. I ain't never seen you, so I don't know who you are. I couldn't identify you.
The boats had drifted apart. Captain Willie went on shouting.
I don't know where this place is where I seen you. I wouldn't know how to get back here.
Okay, came a shout from the booze boat.
I'm taking this big alphabet man fishing until dark, Captain Willie shouted.
Okay.
He loves to fish, Captain Willie yelled, his voice almost breaking. But the son of a bitch claims you can't eat him.
Thanks, brother, came the voice of Harry.
That chap your brother? Asked Frederick Harrison, his face very red, but his love for information still unappeased.
No, sir, said Captain Willie. Most everybody goes in boats, calls each other brother.
We'll go into Key West, Frederick Harrison said, but he said it without great conviction.
No, sir, said Captain Willie. You gentlemen chartered me for a day. I'm going to see you get your money's worth. You called me a half-wit, but I'll see you get a full day's charter.
Take us to Key West, Harrison said.
Yes, sir, said Captain Willie. Later on. But listen, sailfish is just as good eating as kingfish. When we used to sell them to Rio's for the Havana market, we got 10 cents a pound, same as kings.
Oh, shut up, said Frederick Harrison.
I thought you'd be interested in these things as a government man. Ain't you mixed up in the prices of things that we eat or something? Ain't that it? Making them more costly or something? Making the grits cost more and the grunts less?
Oh, shut up, said Harrison. Chapter 8 On the booze boat, Harry had the last sack over. Get me the fish knife, he said to the nigger.
It's gone.
Harry pressed the self-starters and started the two engines. He'd put a second engine in her when he went back to running liquor when the depression had put charter boat fishing on the bum. He got the hatchet and with his left hand chopped the anchor rope through against the bit. It'll sink and they'll grapple it when they pick up the load, he thought. I'll run her up into the garrison bight, and if they're going to take her, they'll take her. I got to get to a doctor. I don't want to lose my arm and the boat both. The load is worth as much as the boat. There wasn't much of it smashed. A little smashed can smell plenty. He shoved the port clutch in and swung out away from the mangroves with the tide. The engines ran smoothly. Captain Willie's boat was 2 miles away now, headed for Boca Grande. I guess the tide's high enough to go through the lakes now, Harry thought. He shoved in his starboard clutch and the engines roared as he picked up the throttle. He could feel her bow rise and the green mangroves coasted swiftly alongside as the boat sucked the water away from their roots. I hope they don't take her, he thought. I hope they can fix my arm. How was I to know they'd shoot at us in Mariel after we could go and come there open for 6 months? That's Cubans for you. Somebody didn't pay somebody, so we got the shooting. That's Cubans, all right. Hey, Wesley, he said, looking back into the cockpit where the nigger lay with the blanket over him. How you feeling?
God, said Wesley. I couldn't feel no worse.
You'll feel worse when the old doctor probes for it, Harry told him.
You ain't human, the nigger said. You ain't got human feelings.
That old Willie is a good skate, Harry was thinking. There's a good skate, that old Willie. We did better to come in than to wait. It was foolish to wait. I felt so dizzy and sick-like,
I lost my judgment.
Ahead now he could see the white of the La Concha Hotel, the wireless masts, and the houses of town. He could see the car ferries lying at the Trumbo dock where he would go around to head up for the Garrison Bight. That old Willie, he thought. He was giving them hell. Wonder who those buzzards were. Damn if I don't feel plenty bad right now. I feel plenty dizzy. We did right to come in. We did right not to wait.
Mr. Harry, said the nigger, I'm sorry I couldn't help dump that stuff.
Hell, said Harry. Ain't no nigger any good when he's shot. You're all right, nigger Wesley.
Above the roar of the motors and the high, slapping rush of the boat through the water, he felt a strange, hollow singing in his heart. He always felt this way coming home at the end of a trip. I hope they can fix that arm, he thought. I got a lot of use for that arm.
Part 3. Harry Morgan. Winter. Chapter 9. Albert speaking. We were all in there at Freddy's place, and this tall, thin lawyer comes in and says, Where's Juan? He ain't back yet, somebody said. I know he's back, and I've got to see him.
Sure, you tipped them off to him, and you got him indicted, and now you're going to defend him, Harry said. Don't you come around here asking where he is. You probably got him in your pocket.
Balls to you, said the lawyer. I've got a job for him.
Well, go look for him someplace else, Harry said. He ain't here.
I've got a job for him, I tell you, the lawyer said.
You ain't got a job for anybody. All you are is poison.
Just then, the old man with the long gray hair over the back of his collar who sells the rubber goods specialties comes in for a quarter of a pint, and Freddy pours it out for him, and he corks it up and scuttles back across the street with it.
What happened to your arm? The lawyer asked Harry.
Harry has the sleeve pinned up to the shoulder.
I didn't like the look of it, so I cut it off, Harry told him.
You and who else cut it off?
Me and a doctor cut it off, Harry said.
He had been drinking and he was getting a little along with it.
I held still and he cut it off. If they cut them off for being in other people's pockets, you wouldn't have no hands nor no feet.
What happened to it that they had to cut it off? The lawyer asked him.
Take it easy, Harry told him.
No, I'm asking you, what happened to it and where were you?
Go bother somebody else, Harry told him. You know where I was and you know what happened. Keep your mouth shut and don't bother me.
I want to talk to you, the lawyer told him.
Then talk to me.
No, in back.
I don't want to talk to you. No good ever comes of you. You're poison.
I've got something for you, something good.
All right, I'll listen to you once, Harry told him.
What's it about, Juan? No, not about Juan.
They went back behind the bend of the bar into where the booths are, and they were gone quite a while. During the time they were gone, Big Lucy's daughter came in with that girl from their place that she's always around with, and they sat at the bar and had a Coca-Cola.
They tell me they ain't going to let no girls out on the streets after 6 o'clock at night, and no girls in any of the places, Freddy says to Big Lucy's daughter.
That's what they say.
It's getting to be a hell of a town, Freddy says.
Hell of a town is right. You just walk outside to get a sandwich and a Coca-Cola and they arrest you and fine you $15.
That's all they pick on now, says Big Lucy's daughter. Any kind of sporting people. Anybody with any sort of a cheerful outlook.
If something don't happen to this town pretty quick, things are going to be bad.
Just then Harry and the lawyer came back out and the lawyer said, You'll be out there then?
Why not bring them here?
No, they don't want to come in. Out there.
All right, Harry said and stepped up to the bar and the lawyer went on out.
What will you have, Al?
He asked me.
Bacardi.
Give us 2 Bacardis, Freddy. Then he turned to me and said, What are you doing now, Al?
Working on the relief.
What doing?
Digging the sewer, taking the old streetcar rails up.
What do you get?
7.5.
A week?
What did you think?
How do you drink in here?
I wasn't till you asked me, I told him.
He edged over a little towards me. You want to make a trip?
Depends on what it is.
We'll talk about that.
All right.
Come on out in the car, he said. So long, Freddy.
He breathed a little fast the way he did when he's been drinking, and I walked up along where the street had been tore up, where we'd been working all day, to the corner where his car was.
Get in, he said.
Where are we going? I asked him.
I don't know, he said. I'm going to find out.
We drove up Whitehead Street, and he didn't say anything. At the head of the street, he turned to the left, and we drove across the head of town to White Street, and out on it to the beach. All the time, Harry didn't say anything, and we turned onto the sand road and drove along it to the boulevard. Out on the boulevard, he pulled the car over to the edge of the sidewalk and stopped.
Some strangers want to charter my boat to make a trip, he said.
The customs got your boat tied up?
The strangers don't know that.
What kind of a trip?
They say they want to carry somebody over that has to go to Cuba to do some business and can't come in by the plane or boat, B-Lips was telling me.
Do they do that?
Sure. All the time since the revolution. It sounds all right. Plenty of people go that way.
What about the boat?
We'll have to steal the boat. You know they ain't got her fixed, so I can't start her.
How are you going to get her out of the sub-base?
I'll get her out.
How are we coming back?
I'll have to figure that. If you don't want to go, say so.
I'd just as soon go if there's any money in it.
Listen, he said. You're making $7.50 a week. You got 3 kids in school that are hungry at noon. You got a family that their bellies hurt, and I give you a chance to make a little money.
You ain't said how much money. You gotta have money for taking chances.
There ain't much money in any kind of chances now, Al, he said. Look at me. I used to make $35 a day right through the season taking people out fishing. Now I get shot and lose an arm and my boat, running a lousy load of liquor that's worth hardly as much as my boat. But let me tell you, my kids ain't going to have their bellies hurt, and I ain't going to dig sewers for the government for less money than we'll feed them. I can't dig now anyway. I don't know who made the laws, but I know there ain't no law that you gotta go hungry.
I went out on strike against those wages, I told him.
And you come back to work, he said. They said you were striking against charity. You always worked, didn't you? You never asked anybody for charity.
There ain't any work, I said. There ain't any work at living wages anywhere.
Why?
I don't know.
Neither do I, he said. But my family is going to eat as long as anybody eats. What they're trying to do is starve you conks out of here so they can burn down the shacks and put up apartments and make this a tourist town. That's what I hear. I hear they're buying up lots, and then after the poor people are starved out and gone somewhere else to starve some more, they're going to come in and make it into a beauty spot for tourists.
You talk like a radical, I said.
I ain't no radical, he said. I'm sore. I've been sore a long time.
Losing your arm don't make you feel better.
The hell with my arm. You lose an arm, you lose an arm. There's worse things than losing an arm. You've got 2 arms and you've got 2 of something else. And a man's still a man with 1 arm or with 1 of those. The hell with it, he says. I don't want to talk about it. Then after a minute he says, I got those other 2 still. Then he started the car and said, come on, we'll go see these fellows.
We rode along the boulevard, with the breeze blowing, and a few cars going past, and the smell of dead seagrass on the cement where the waves had gone over the seawall at high tide, Harry driving with his left arm. I always liked him all right, and I'd gone in a boat with him plenty of times in the old days. But he was changed now, since he lost his arm and that fella down visiting from Washington made an affidavit that he saw the boat unloading liquor that time, and the customs seized her. When he was in a boat, he always felt good, and without his boat he felt plenty bad. I think he was glad of an excuse to steal her. He knew he couldn't keep her, but maybe he could make a piece of money with her while he had her. I needed money bad enough, but I didn't want to get in any trouble. I said to him, you know I don't want to get in any real trouble, Harry.
What worse trouble you going to get in than you're in now, he said. What the hell worse trouble is there than starving?
I'm not starving, I said. What the hell you always talking about starving for?
Maybe you're not, but your kids are.
Cut it out, I said. I'll work with you, but you can't talk that way to me.
All right, he said. But be sure you want the job. I can get plenty of men in this town.
I want it, I said. I told you I want it.
Then cheer up.
You cheer up, I said. You're the only one that's talking like a radical.
Ah, cheer up, he said. None of you conks has any guts.
Since when ain't you a conk?
Since the first good meal I ever ate. He was mean talking now, all right, and since he was a boy, he never had no pity for nobody. But he never had no pity for himself, either.
All right, I said to him.
Take it easy, he said. Ahead of us, I could see the lights of this place. We're going to meet them here, Harry said. Keep your mouth buttoned up.
The hell with you.
Ah, take it easy, Harry said as we turned into the runway and drove around to the back of the place. He was a bully, and he was bad-spoken, but I always liked him all right. We stopped the car in back of this place and went into the kitchen where the man's wife was cooking at a stove. Hello, Frida, Harry said to her. Where's B-Lips?
He's right in there, Harry. Hello, Albert.
Hello, Miss Richards, I said. I knew her ever since she used to be in Jungletown. But two or three of the hardest-working married women in town used to be sporting women, and this was a hard-working woman, I tell you that.
Your folks all well? She asked me.
They're all fine.
We went on through the kitchen and into this back room. There was B-Lips, the lawyer, and four Cubans with him sitting at a table.
Sit down, said one of them in English.
He was a tough-looking fellow, heavy, with a big face, and a voice deep in his throat, and he'd been drinking plenty, you could see.
What's your name?
What's yours? Said Harry.
All right, said this Cuban. Have it your own way. Where's the boat?
She's down at the yacht basin, Harry said.
Who's this? The Cuban asked him, looking at me.
My mate, Harry said. The Cuban was looking me over, and the other Cubans were looking us both over.
He looks hungry, the Cuban said, and laughed.
The others didn't laugh.
You want a drink?
All right, Harry said.
What, Bacardi?
Whatever you're drinking, Harry told him.
Does your mate drink?
I'll have one, I said.
Nobody asked you yet, the big Cuban said. I just asked if you drank.
Oh, cut it out, Roberto.
One of the other Cubans, a young one, not much more than a kid, said. Can't you do anything without getting nasty?
What do you mean, nasty? I just asked if he drinks. If you hire somebody, don't you ask if he drinks?
Give him a drink, said the other Cuban. Let's talk business.
What you want for the boat, big boy?
The deep-voiced Cuban called Roberto asked Harry. Depends on what you want to do with her, Harry said.
Take the four of us to Cuba.
Where in Cuba?
Cabañas. Close to Cabañas. Down the coast from Mariel. You know where it is?
Sure, said Harry. Just take you there?
That's all. Take us there and put us ashore.
$300.
Too much. What if we charter you by the day and guarantee you 2 weeks' charter?
$40 a day, and you put up $1,500 for if anything happens to the boat. Do I have to clear it?
No.
You pay for the gas and oil, Harry told them.
We'll give you $200 to take us over there and put us ashore.
No.
How much do you want?
I told you.
That's too much.
No, it isn't, Harry told him. I don't know who you are, I don't know what your business is, and I don't know who shoots at you. I gotta cross the Gulf twice in the winter time. Anyway, I'm risking my boat. I'll carry you for 200, and you can put up 1,000 for a guarantee nothing happens to the boat.
That's reasonable, B-Lips told him. That's more than reasonable.
The Cubans started talking in Spanish. I couldn't understand them, but I knew Harry could.
All right, the big one, Roberto said. When can you start?
Any time tomorrow night.
Maybe we don't want to go until the night after,
one of them said.
That's okay with me, Harry said. Only let me know in time.
Is your boat in good shape?
Sure, said Harry. She is a nice-looking boat, the young one of them said.
Where did you see her?
Mr. Simmons, the lawyer here, showed her to me.
Oh, said Harry.
Have a drink, said another of the Cubans. Have you been to Cuba much?
A few times.
Speak Spanish?
I never learned it, Harry said.
I saw B-Lips, the lawyer, look at him, but he is so crooked himself that he's always more pleased if people aren't telling the truth. Just like when he came in to speak to Harry about this job, he couldn't speak to him straight. He had to pretend he wanted to see Juan Rodriguez, who is a poor stinking gallego that would steal from his own mother that B-Lips has got indicted again so he can defend him.
Mr. Simmons speaks good Spanish, the Cuban said. He's got an education. Can you navigate?
I can go and I can come.
You're a fisherman?
Yes, sir, said Harry.
How do you fish with one arm? The big-faced one asked.
You just fish twice as fast, Harry told him. Did you want to see me about anything else?
No. They were all talking Spanish together.
Then I'll go, said Harry.
I'll let you know about the boat, B-Lips told Harry.
There's some money got to be put up, Harry said.
We'll do that tomorrow.
Well, good night, Harry told them.
Good night, said the young pleasant-speaking one. The big-faced one didn't say anything. There were two others with faces like Indians that hadn't said anything at all any of the time except to talk in Spanish to the big-faced one.
I'll see you later on, B-Lips said.
Where?
At Freddy's.
We went out and through the kitchen again, and Frida said, How's Marie, Harry?
She's fine now, Harry told her. She's feeling good now.
And we went out the door. We got in the car, and he drove back to the boulevard and didn't say anything at all. He was thinking about something, all right.
Should I drop you home?
All right.
You live out on the county road now?
Yes. What about the trip?
I don't know, he said. I don't know whether there's going to be any trip. See you tomorrow.
He drops me in front of where we live, and I go on in, and I haven't got the door open before my old woman has given me hell for staying out and drinking and being late to the meal. I ask her how I can drink with no money, and she says I must be running a credit. I ask her who she thinks will give me credit when I'm working on the relief, and she says to keep my rummy breath away from her and sit down to the table. So I sit down. The kids are all gone to the diamond ball game, and I sit there at the table, and she brings the supper and won't speak to me.
Chapter 10. Harry.
I don't want to fool with her, but what choice have I got? They don't give you any choice now. I can let it go, but what will the next thing be? I didn't ask for any of this, and if you've got to do it, you've got to do it. Probably I shouldn't take Albert. He's dumb, but he's straight and he's a good man in a boat. He doesn't spook too easy, but I don't know whether I ought to take him. But I can't take no rummy nor no nigger. I got to have somebody I can depend on. If we make it, I'll see he gets a share. But I can't tell him or he wouldn't go into it, and I gotta have somebody by me. It would be better alone. Anything is better alone. But I don't think I can handle it alone. It would be much better alone. Albert is better off if he don't know anything about it. The only thing is B-Lips. There's B-Lips that will know about everything. Still, they must have thought about that. They must figure on that. Do you suppose B-Lips is so dumb he won't know that's what they will do? I wonder. Of course, maybe that isn't what they figure to do. Maybe they aren't going to do any such thing. But it's natural that's what they would do, and I heard that word. If they do it, they'll have to do it just when it closes, or they'll have the Coast Guard plane down from Miami. It's dark now at 6. She can't fly it down under an hour. Once it's dark, they're all right. Well, if I'm going to carry them, I gotta figure out about the boat. She won't be hard to get out, but if I take her out tonight and they find she's gone, they'll maybe find her. Anyway, there will be a big fuss. Tonight's the only time I've got to get her out, though. I can take her out with the tide, and I can hide her. I can see what she needs, if she needs anything, if they've taken off anything. But I gotta fill gas and water. I got a hell of a busy night, all right. Then when I've got her hid, Albert will have to bring them in a speedboat. Maybe Walton's. I can hire her. Or B-Lips can hire. That's better. B-Lips can help me get the boat out tonight. B-Lips is the one. Because sure as hell they figured about B-Lips.